From 89.7 WUWM, Milwaukee's NPR, this is Lake Effect. I'm Joy Powers. Today we'll hear from a Wisconsinite impacted by the Trump administration's USAID freeze.
So this is our first time offering a program like this. I think all of us were curious to see what the response would be, and we're thrilled to see there was a lot of enthusiasm for it.
We'll learn about new efforts to support young people experiencing homelessness in Milwaukee. Plus, we'll learn how one entomologist is changing hearts and minds on the importance of insects.
All it takes sometimes is a snippet of wonder and some imagination and some real-life examples of how insects have interacted or related with humans throughout history to really inspire and alter people's perspectives about insects.
All of that is coming up on Lake Effect. But first, here are today's headlines. This is Lake Effect from 89.7 WUWM, Milwaukee's NPR. I'm Joy Powers, and thank you so much for joining us. One of the first federal agencies the Trump administration has targeted in its attempt to downsize the federal government is the U.S. Agency for International Development, also known as USAID. The agency provides food in countries where there is famine, medication to people in poverty around the globe, and aids farmers and small businesses in the developing world and war-torn areas. In the past 2 weeks, the Trump administration has ordered dozens of senior officials to be put on leave. The administration has laid off thousands of contractors, and it's frozen billions of dollars in humanitarian assistance to other countries. Organizations that contract with USAID have challenged Trump's actions in a federal lawsuit, but the administration has continued to defy court orders that challenge the legality of its actions. Till Brewitt is a Wisconsin native who works for DAI. It's a global development firm that contracts with USAID on international aid. We heard from him yesterday on what's happening and how it's affecting his work. Today we'll hear the rest of his conversation with WUWM's Mayon Silver about what happens next.
Some of these efforts to halt aid and slash staff have been challenged in court by labor unions, the American Foreign Service Association, and others. They're arguing it's unconstitutional for a president to eliminate a federal agency approved by Congress, and that this is causing a global humanitarian crisis. On Friday, a federal judge temporarily halted some Trump and Musk efforts to put thousands of overseas workers on administrative leave, but he didn't grant a temporary block on the funding freeze. There will be more hearings and more lawsuits. What do you think about all that?
Yeah, well, one, I'm happy that they have a freeze on USAID staff. As mentioned, when USAID is able to truly determine which projects, or the State Department is able to truly determine which projects they need to move forward, then they could make a more educated decision about which staff they need and which staff they don't. I understand that that stay is only through February 14th. That's probably not long enough for that review to take place.
You're talking about the stay that blocks putting thousands of overseas workers on administrative leave, right?
Correct. Both the overseas workers as well as some of the USAID workers who are based in Washington, D.C. In terms of the courts, I think, as an example, for companies like ours and also other NGOs, as I understand it, we are also going to court first and foremost to receive the back payment, to receive what is owed to us from before this administration came in. Those payments are legally due to us. They're contractually due to us. There's no reason that they're being contested. We've not received notice. We are due that money. I think that is really important right now because, as mentioned, we've basically written the United States government a huge check right now, and we're not getting repaid for that. That will allow us to at least maintain operations, so that if there are some of our projects, hopefully several of our projects that do continue, we actually have the staff and resources to go ahead and move forward with them. But the courts take time, and there are so many other challenges that the courts are facing. My concern is that we're running out of time, a lot of us. Some 90% of the organizations that work with USAID are facing significant cash flow shortages. And also, the majority of them have resorted to furloughs and layoffs in the last week.
This administration is essentially trying to gut this agency. I have two questions. Number one, How unprecedented is it? Would you classify it as illegal? I know that's going through the courts, but in your perspective, and why do you think USAID is one of the first agencies that Doge, Musk's Department of Government Efficiency, has been targeting?
Yeah, on the first question, I mean, I know what I read in the paper, and I know what I read, you know, what I know of USAID. I do believe that the president alone is not able to just dismantle USAID, that it would take an act of Congress to do that. So Congress will need to act, and Congress may choose to act. There are other countries who have folded their development agencies into their foreign ministries. So that is, there is some precedent for that. However, I don't believe that the president has the legal authority to do it on his own. In terms of, you know, gutting it, I think the question is then, the US has hundreds and hundreds of different contracts out there. How are they going to live up to the commitments of those contracts if they remove all the staff that know how to manage them from USAID? So that just seems really short-sighted, and I think it's just going to lead to a lot more confusion. In terms of why USAID was chosen first, and I do think in many ways, and this is my personal opinion, has nothing to do with my profession, I do think that USAID is an interesting test case for the administration on how far to push executive authority versus congressional or judicial authority. It's a small agency. It doesn't have a huge domestic constituency because the people that benefit most from our support are largely overseas. They're largely poor people. They're people that don't necessarily have a voice here. That makes it more vulnerable. And I think people have always had some suspicion about the purpose of foreign aid. So it's just an easier organization, I think, to pick out because it's not as well known by Americans. My hope is that as the trickle-down effect is felt, as different companies and farmers and others in America do start to feel the impact of the trimming back and the stop work order at USAID, that people will start to realize how it really impacts them.
Is there anything else that, you know, just really keeps you up at night about this?
I will confess, last week, as everything was happening and I was furloughed, that did wake me up quite early in the morning, thinking about the fact that I didn't have a job, I don't have an income at present. Also, as mentioned, we're an employee-owned company, so I have shares in a company which right now, I would imagine, if you were to estimate what they're worth, is pretty much zero. And that was going to be part of my retirement. But that wakes me up in the morning. I think not necessarily what keeps me up at night. I think what keeps me up at night right now, immediately, is I have colleagues, both Americans who've been furloughed or laid off, as well as my foreign colleagues who are in far worse position than I am. I mean, I can withstand for several months to not be able to find work, and I think I'll have a good chance of finding something. But I know others that are just not in a position. They're struggling already to make rent. They can't pay for childcare. And that's not even to mention, you know, some of our local colleagues and projects overseas where they're supporting entire families on their salary. And then you get to the beneficiaries of our projects. You know, we may be abandoning them in a time of great need. I mean, most of the people that we're serving are in fact in need at present. And so we're abandoning them, and we're not paying them, and we're not doing what we promised for them. And that concerns me too. I worry about what's going to happen to all of them. And then, yes, I mean, I do wake up thinking, what's this world going to be? A foreign aid, foreign assistance, yeah, it can be done better. There's no doubt about it. But when it works well, in my opinion, it's peace and stability on the cheap. You know, as you already know, the foreign assistance budget is well less than 1% of the federal budget. So if you look at it compared to the defense spending budget, it's less than 10% of defense, usually around 7 or 8% of what the defense budget is. And foreign aid does do its part to reduce conflict, to create more economic and political stability in countries. It helps governments prepare and invest in their people and their infrastructure so there are actually fewer emergencies that then require immediate assistance. And it also just allows governments to better respond to their own emergencies rather than countries like the US and international organizations having to step in. And all of that are things that I think most Americans would be behind. And if you really play the long game, I mean, foreign aid is not a short game, it's a long game. And the long game also has to do with American power. Yes, it's about soft power, but actually it's also about hard power. You know, I think we all know, that when we step back from providing this kind of support, there are going to be others ready to step in, and they're not going to be the other countries that we would wish would. So China has the Belt and Road Initiative. They've been spreading throughout the developing world and through loans and other types of support, really buying influence across the planet. And I think a lot of what we're doing is actually combating some of that influence. And of course, there's Russia, Russian influence. What happens if we no longer support the countries such as Ukraine, who have actually been subject to Russian aggression, and Georgia, but other countries in the region? So I do worry in the long run what it's going to do to America's standing in the world.
What do people who work at places like DAI and USAID, what do they do if the agency is gutted and there's 70% or 80% less work that goes along with it?
Yeah, well, in addition to worrying about, you know, my colleagues overseas and our beneficiaries, I worry about that too. There are over 10,000 employees at USAID alone. There are thousands more that have worked to support USAID that are spread all around the country and all around the globe. And so we're faced with this like triple threat. Not only is our company going under, our industry is being decimated and our market is disappearing. And so it is really hard to see, you know, a way forward. There are other opportunities out there. There are still charitable foundations, group like the Gates Foundation, Omidyar Foundation, Rockefeller Foundation, who are doing good work overseas. So there can be opportunities there. And then there are also other international organizations and other countries' donor programs that need the kinds of skills that people have. But it is a challenge. USAID is such an important actor in foreign assistance globally that its disappearance from the scene is going to have a ripple effect across the globe. And as for my colleagues, I mean, I think people have this idea that we don't know how to do anything but push paper, that we're just bureaucrats. It's actually not true. I work with a lot of people who just have mad skills, whether it be in agriculture or environment, in sciences, in health. They can deploy these skills someplace else, including in the United States. They've chosen to do it overseas for whatever reason they have, but they've got something to offer. And so I think in the medium term and the long term, a lot of those people will find work and will find great ways to contribute to their societies.
But it'll also be flooding the market with people that have those types of skills.
It is already flooded. If I go onto LinkedIn and I look at my professional contacts, probably about 30 to 40% of them now have open for work listed on their site. So it is overwhelming.
Till Brewitt of DAI, a global development firm that contracts with USAID on international aid. He's based in Madison. Thank you so much for speaking to us at Lake Effect.
No, thank you so much for taking the time to speak to me on this important issue.
Till Brewitt works for DAI, which contracts with USAID. He spoke with WUWM's Mayan Silver, and you can hear the full conversation at WUWM.com. The Wisconsin Historical Society will install 12 new historical markers that represent some of Wisconsin's underrepresented history. 8 of those markers will be located in Milwaukee County. The Historical Society is collaborating with several groups on the project, including the Organization of Chinese Americans, the Wisconsin Black Historical Society, and Hispanic Scholarship Foundation. Mallory Hansen is the statewide services coordinator at the Wisconsin Historical Society. She joins WUWM's Eddie Morales to share more about this project.
So there are more than 600 historical markers throughout the state. How are those markers used to educate and preserve history?
That's a great question. So Wisconsin state historical markers tell the stories about events, individuals, buildings, or sites of local, state, or national significance. So it's a really great way to have place-based education. So it's a unique program in the sense that a lot of the times where they're located is exactly where the event happened. So you're learning about the past in the same location where that history was made. So it makes a more tangible connection.
So there are 12 new markers planned for installation. How did the idea start to install these markers, specifically that elevate underrepresented history?
Yeah, so the Wisconsin Historical Society's markers program has existed. It was established in 1953. So when we looked at the program, it's been incredibly popular, and it's something that's unique because it's community driven. So anyone can apply for a marker, and you just have to submit an application. There's certain criteria that it needs to meet, but then it can be established. And as we were looking at the program, we did an assessment to take a look at, out of these 600 markers, what topics are covered, which ones aren't, and just really taking time to re-envision what does the markers program look like in the 21st century. So for us, we were looking at it and saw this as an opportunity to expand the stories that are told across the program. So we decided to issue a special call for marker topics that are currently underrepresented. And very fortunate to be working with the William G. Pomeroy Foundation. So they supplied a very generous grant for the Historical Society to help support that initiative to re-envision the program. So we decided to do kind of a re-granting program is how we look at it, where we made the funds available for community applicants and then published that in February. After that, people could apply, and we had all these really great topics come in for the program, reviewed it, and then we were able to allocate funding for 12 of those.
How unique is that to receive a grant that was over $75,000?
I'm fairly new to the marker program, so I don't know if I can speak to as much in the past, but my understanding is I think this is one of the first grants that we've received that's this large for the markers program in particular. The Pomeroy Foundation has a very generous support for state historical markers, so they've worked with other programs in the country besides Wisconsin's, but very grateful for that support.
What was the response like from community groups that submitted applications, and then how were those 12 markers throughout the state and the 5 in Milwaukee County, how were those selected?
So this is our first time offering a program like this. I think all of us were curious to see what the response would be, and we're thrilled to see there was a lot of enthusiasm for it. So we reached out to contacts throughout the state, encouraging them to apply. So very positive response. I think everyone was excited about the program, an opportunity to participate. For the selection process, people filled out an application. It's submitted to the State Historical Society, and we had a review committee take a look at all the applications and then look at the qualifications and criteria to be eligible for it. And then preference was given to topics that were underrepresented also in the program too. So that 5-member panel composed of Historical Society staff reviewed applications and selected the recipients. For part of the process for this is they apply for a grant. They're notified that they receive funding for the marker. And then after that, they submit a complete state historical marker application. So in that process, people are including their proposed text for the marker, supporting sources that and kind of like a bibliography. From there, the marker review committee at the State Historical Society reviews it, fact checks, helps support revising, and then we'll finally get to placing the order.
Can you tell me a little bit about some of the markers coming to Milwaukee County?
So we are working with Midtown Neighborhood Alliance for this marker, and it's going to be discussing Linden Hill and the history of that site. So Linden Hill is very unique for that one because it's got a pretty rich history of lots of different things have happened on this site. So it starts out talking about the origin of a hospital that was founded by 2 French Canadian nuns that moved to Milwaukee, how it was transitioned into becoming a community economic base and medical center. And when the sisters that had founded the hospital closed it, they moved to Brookfield. And then there were 3 African-American doctors that bought the hospital and really kept it alive. after that, and it was a thriving center for the community. So it is a now demolished and it's a vacant lot, but it's been turned into now a park space. So that one's really just kind of looking at the history, how we came to get to the park, history of the hospital and that transition.
Yeah, thanks for that. The second marker is, well, two new markers developed in collaboration with the Organization of Chinese Americans, and that's expected to be installed in the summer. And that will share stories of the Forest Home Cemetery and the Chinese Laundry era. So what is it about the cemetery and the Chinese Laundry era that's significant to the history of Chinese people in Milwaukee?
Yeah, I think for the Laundry era in particular, it's a really important piece of history that we want to be sharing because it's the laundry business as well as restaurant business is really how a lot of early Chinese immigrants were making their livings in Milwaukee and establishing themselves as part of the community. So it's looking at this chunk of time and how people use those business opportunities to make Milwaukee their home, establish a community as well, and then looking just at that legacy. Similarly, with this cemetery, it's a lot of early Chinese immigrants to Milwaukee are buried there. So they have a section in Forest Grove where quite a few of them are there. And the marker is also going to be looking at tomb sweeping and the cultural practices that are involved with that too.
And then third, in collaboration with UW-Milwaukee, a new marker will explore the significance of Wisconsin's first Black registered architect, Alonzo Robinson Jr. Can you share any details about that?
I'm sad to say this one I have a little bit less knowledge of, so I don't really want to provide too much for that one. They haven't submitted their final marker application quite yet, so there's a little bit of a lag on that one.
Okay. The next marker, so three new markers developed with the Wisconsin Black Historical Society, and they'll share stories about several important figures. Is there anything about that that you can share?
Yeah, so there are going to be covering three topics for that. We have Bernice Lindsay is going to be one of the markers, Lloyd A. Barraby, and then St. Mark the Church are the three main topic areas. So really important locations as well as individuals and looking at the history. So excited to be partnering with them. Bernice Lindsay moved to Milwaukee in 1928, so she really loved the people of the community and worked in important institutions like YWCA and really helped found and part of the Human Rights Initiative and commissions in Milwaukee. So excited to have that too.
The next marker is in collaboration with the Wisconsin Hispanic Scholarship Foundation, highlighting urban civil rights activism that began in the 60s. Can you share anything about that?
So this marker is really going to be exploring the geographic heart of the Latino urban civil rights activism, which began in the 1960s on Milwaukee's south side. So it's looking at the key organizations that spurred that activism, nonprofit organizations such as Latin American Union for Civil Rights is one of the institutions that will be highlighted and really just looking at that movement in Milwaukee.
The markers will be installed this year through summer and fall, but where can people go to stay updated on that?
So our most up-to-date information is going to be on our website, wisconsinhistory.org. And if you search for the markers program, we do have a map that includes a link that has a list where all of them are, titles and content.
Is there anything else you'd like to add?
Nothing other than I think we're all just really excited for the opportunity to be working with communities to share this history. It's really great to see that in, established.
Yeah, thanks again for taking the time out. I really appreciate it.
No, of course. I'm happy to talk about it. The Markers program is close to my heart.
Mallory Hansen is the statewide services coordinator at the Wisconsin Historical Society. She spoke with WUWM's Eddie Morales about the society's effort to elevate underrepresented history. And did you know you can listen to Lake Effect as a podcast? Search for Lake Effect wherever you get your podcasts to download and listen on demand. Did you know Americans once farmed black widow spiders for their silk? In about 15 minutes, we'll learn how humanity's ancient relationship with bugs has changed our world. That's coming up next on Lake Effect on 89.7 WUWM, Milwaukee's NPR.
Thank you.
You're listening to Lake Effect on 89.7 WUWM. I'm Joy Powers. Nationwide, an estimated 1 in 10 young people will experience homelessness this year. Locally, Pathfinders is one of a few organizations providing emergency housing and support for homeless youth. Now the organization is finding solutions to youth homelessness through the people who best understand the problem, young people themselves. The Power of Paths Youth Action Board is comprised of young people 11 and older who have experienced homelessness and are giving recommendations based on their experiences. Pathfinders recently received a $3.1 million grant to implement solutions that its board recommended, including investments in emergency housing and child care support for young parents looking to continue their education. The board was featured in this month's Milwaukee Magazine, and Lake Effect's Sam Woods spoke to Pathfinders and members of the board to learn more.
Zatira Hull was a nerd before it was cool. Back in high school, she had a multitude of interests, from debate club to doodling.
I used to be in a corner drawing anime pictures and stuff like that. Like, kids weren't really for that back in my era.
Zatira, who also goes by Z, was also adopted. And when she legally became an adult, she said she was abruptly kicked out of the house by her foster guardians.
When I hit 18, it was like, yeah, my check cut off, so you cut off too. Like, you gotta go. So, like, literally, like, my 18th birthday, I was outside that night trying to figure out where I was going to go. So, yeah, that's basically how I became homeless. I didn't really know what homeless meant until then, honestly.
Z's story is common. Nationally, about 1 in 10 young people aged 10 to 24 will experience homelessness this year, and that includes sleeping on the streets, in shelters, and couch surfing. Formed in 1970, Pathfinders is a nonprofit organization based in Milwaukee and dedicated to helping homeless and housing insecure youth find and sustain safe housing. Once housed, it offers support to youth seeking mental well-being, education, employment, and other personal goals. Z said she leaned on Pathfinders throughout her life, but especially when she was kicked out. She found support there in the form of a bed, therapy, and clothing. And Pathfinders leaned on her as well, drawing from her expertise to create a program for youth like her exiting the foster system without anywhere to go.
I think I was one of the first young people that actually helped them create the program for young people that's aging out the system, who has no support after aging out of the system. I think I was one of those very, very first people that like helped them put that together and was like, okay, I'm the test run.
This would be one of many examples of Z making the world around her just a little softer, and one of many examples of Pathfinders trusting youth to be the experts. The Power of Paths Youth Action Board, organized by Pathfinders, is a group of young people ages 11 and older who have experienced homelessness. With the support of Pathfinders, the group devises solutions to youth homelessness, such as immediate rehousing and transitional living support, and childcare support for young parents looking to continue their education. Z is the president of the Power of Paths Board, working closely with other young people like Markel Crawford, who is now the vice president of the board. Markel remembers being an inquisitive teenager, always wanting to know more about the world. But his living circumstances were not always in his control.
I was like 17, and my mom, she actually was helping like a friend of hers who was homeless. And that friend, somehow the rent money ended up in her hands. And one day she said, we gotta leave. You need to find somewhere to go. So I really didn't even know where to go to. So I asked her like, so how, where?
Like Z, Markel would lean on Pathfinders for support, both in terms of a bed and roof, but also in terms of communal love. Joseph Stanley, or Uncle Joe, as Z and Markel call him, is a therapist at Pathfinders. And he's one of those people that make you say, ah, if only everyone was just a bit more like you. Or, as Markel and Z tell it,
no, that man literally doesn't stop working. He's the first person in and the last person out every day for sure. That's for sure.
You know that one Christmas song when they were like, never stop, he never stop working. Like, Waymaker, miracle worker, promise keeper, light in the darkness. My God, that is who you are. In a way, like Joseph, he put himself in that position many times. Like when people don't have transportation, he'll drive to you, get you bus tickets. Maybe he'll be your ride. You need food. He makes sure that you can get that food. So it was times where food was put in my house because Joseph okayed it. It was times I had transportation. It was times I had a bed to lay on many times. My first personal bed was from him. He said, yeah, I had this for 10 years, but it still served me like half to maybe even 10 years of that time.
When I talked to Zee and Markel about misconceptions people who have not experienced homelessness carry about those who have, they spoke of assumptions. Assumptions that these young people just aren't trying hard enough, or that they don't have, quote, the look of someone who's homeless. DeShonda Williams-Clark knows this story well. She's the chief programs officer at Pathfinders, and she said these assumptions often stem from seeing homeless youth as adults.
When it comes to young people, there's always this adultist way of viewing them. And so when you are seeing young people that have nowhere to go each day, it's just easy for people to assume that, oh, they're just not listening, or they're just, you know, not good kids, or something along that line, when in reality it's deeper than that. And there's so many more barriers to why people are facing the traumas and hardships that they're facing in life. So. Yeah, it's a lot of assumption, and it comes from folks that maybe even never had those experiences, or some people that maybe they did have experiences, but they were able to come out of that because of whatever other supports they may have had. And so they feel like, well, why can't you just pull yourself up by your bootstraps? And it's just not a fair judgment to place on anyone.
The Power of Paths Youth Action Board recently received a $3.1 million grant to implement solutions that the board outlined. As mentioned earlier, these solutions include direct support in the form of things like emergency housing and childcare for young parents. If you ask Zee and Markel about ways to immediately address youth homelessness, they'd say direct support like this is vital. But ask a follow-up about cultural changes needed to address this issue, Zee will remind you to tap into your empathy, because most of us are only one or two setbacks away from homelessness.
Having these organizations open and having these people that's out here with actual pure intentions and pure hearts to do the work that needs to be done for the young people and for people that's homeless, period. It's not just, you know, yeah, we're focusing on the young people, but everybody of age, color, everything goes through homelessness.
And Markel will remind you that our economic system encourages individualism and that maybe there's more Uncle Joes out there than we realize. People who are capable of supporting youth in need, but feel like they just don't have the time to give back.
So a lot of times I have to take care of myself. So a lot of my attention and focus that I can be put into the community is put into a system that tried to keep you doing this work that makes you the money right now. And another thing I would say, it can be time. Like, maybe we could have more time dedicated, but that still is tied in with capitalism. We could have more time dedicated to solving these problems instead of in survival mode. Like, to be a person that's having a big impact in the community, but still being in survival mode, that's taken away from the community.
In the end, DeShonda sees initiatives like the Power of Paths Board as essential for addressing big issues like youth homelessness. After all, who really knows the problem better than those who have experienced it?
People will tell you what they need to be successful, and that's why Pathfinders, that's why young people are giving the feedback about Pathfinders the way that they are. So when we're writing grants, we're partnering with young people, and they're telling me specifically, this is what we should do. We need more housing units. We need more transitional housing. So those are the things that we write for. They say, I could prioritize my education and going to school if I had a roof over my head or if the adults in my household had an income that matched the cost of living. And so if it is on the agenda of those folks that make those decisions, then folks could be better off.
That story was produced by Lake Effect's Sam Woods and features clips from Zatiah Hull, Markel Crawford, and Deshonda Williams-Clark. The Pathfinder's Power of Paths Youth Action Board was featured in this month's Milwaukee Magazine. A new season of Bubbler Talk is on the way, and we need some new questions. Submit your questions about the Milwaukee area at WUWM.com. How much time do you spend thinking about bugs? Unless they infiltrate your home, probably not much. But they have had a big impact on our lives. We'll learn about that next on Lake Effect on 89.7 WUWM, Milwaukee's NPR. This is Lake Effect on 89.7 WUWM. I'm Joy Powers. Insects may sometimes seem like a scourge on humanity, but without them, our lives would look very different. The quintillions of insects that inhabit our world help feed us, clothe us, and have changed the way we interact with one another. A book called The Insect Epiphany explores the ancient relationship between humanity and insects. Author Barrett Klein is an animal behavior biologist and entomologist at UW La Crosse, and he joins me to explore more. When you talk with people, what are the general perceptions of insects and their contributions to humanity?
Oftentimes, conversations can begin with trepidation, repulsion, fear, or general curiosity. And I think all it takes sometimes is a snippet of wonder and some imagination and some real life examples of how insects have interacted or related with humans throughout history to really inspire and alter people's perspectives about insects. So for example, I study something a little odd. I study sleep behavior in social insects, and people cock their heads and think about that, and they ask, note that they didn't even know that insects slept, right? And what does that mean to sleep? And similarly, when you bring up examples of clandestine ways in which insects have infiltrated our culture in very positive respects, it can open people's minds and eyes.
This book is really full of interesting ways that insects have kind of infiltrated our lives, and then the ways in which we have drawn from insects to benefit our lives. As you were putting together this book, what were some of the most surprising facts for you as someone who is really deep in this world?
Yeah, there were so many. And that was actually the biggest joy of writing this book, was the idea of jumping down rabbit holes and really learning about not only the overt, explicit ways, like honeybees and their honey and beeswax and pollination contributions and butterflies and as symbols culturally affecting dances and indigenous peoples' rights, but then the really secret hidden ways that I never expected could exist. So for example, when I was exploring the most ancient ways that peoples had associated with insects, one example that kind of blew me away was the oldest complete and decipherable sentence in any alphabetic script was found on a little comb, a fine-toothed nit or louse comb to remove head lice. And the 17 letters spell out, "May this tusk root out the lice of the hair and the beard." The great part was the archaeologist Garfinkel, Josef Garfinkel, who was one of the discoverers, responded to one person with, "What were you expecting? A love song? A recipe to make pizza?" But for example, who was the first astronaut in space? It wasn't Yuri Gagarin, and it wasn't a dog. It wasn't a chimpanzee. Was fruit flies in 1946 and then 1947. Who was the first earthling to give birth to offspring conceived in space? It was a cockroach on Europe's Photon M3. And then where did the ink come from for some of the most famous documents in history, like the Declaration of Independence and the Magna Carta and the U.S. Constitution? Well, it's from oak gall wasps producing oak gall ink, plants protecting themselves as the developing insects would instigate a chemical cascade and then this physical protection that served, ironically, as shelter and protection for the insect, produced tannins, which then could be used as this long-lasting ink.
Very long-lasting. We still have these documents.
That's right. That's right.
The book is really an exploration of all of these things. It's split up into different sections, working with insects, making insects, becoming them. I think people are going to be most familiar with this first section, the idea of working with insects. But this, of course, takes a lot of different forms. What are some of the common ways that we work with insects, products that they might give us or that we use them for?
This was so much fun to explore and pretty easy for me to categorize because first I thought about the products, as you mentioned, what are insects producing and how can we exploit the insects with these products for our gain? And then how do we use body parts or whole bodies, dead, alive of insects? You've got some ancient and long-lasting uses from silk to bees, wax, honey, to true bugs, lacquer, colors, and then paper inspired by insects, chitin, venoms, and poisons that have been used to either cure, kill, or transform. I start with silk just because it's probably the most important in some ways. And it's such a strange history because there are very few insects that we've domesticated. And for 5,000 years, we've domesticated this one out of over 180,000 species of moths and butterflies, this one, Bombyx mori, and to such an extent that they can no longer fly in nature. So here we've got this silk that we use not only for fabrics and textiles, some little scraps of which exist from thousands of years ago, so it's long-lasting, but also it has other utilitarian value. It's very consistent, it's super strong, and somewhat flexible, and of course it has that luster. So people have used it in ways that involve optics, little guides, whether it be observational equipment for astronomy or for the military. If we depart from silkworm moths to black widow spider silk or other spider silk, there were farms in the US during World War I and II to produce the silk to use in those ways. And even World War I explosives from the US, 100% of them were delivered in silk pouches because silk has this weird property where if it burns or explodes, it doesn't leave ash or any residue behind. If I were to guess, I'd say that of all the insect products, silk is probably number one in terms of being represented in museums and galleries and people's homes, either as canvases or as piecemeal parts holding things together. And that's just a fiber that's used to produce a cocoon so an insect can pupate or go through full metamorphosis to winged adulthood. Then you look at products like honeybee's wax and honey and propolis and our history of robbing colonies to keeping colonies and even looking to them in terms of their decision-making and their efficient division of labor. And then you've got the true bugs in the order Hemiptera. So all bugs are insects, but not all insects are bugs. So the bugs belonging to this one order have piercing, sucking mouth parts as immatures and adults. And some of them don't look insect-like at all, even as adults. And these are the scale bugs. And one species of scale bug produces the only animal resin that humans have exploited, and that's lac turned shellac. And you'll see those coat sculptures, coat wood floors, coat furniture. Lac was used to make 78 RPM records, dyes, red dyes in textiles. So the list goes on and on and on. We used to spray our hair and use it in cosmetics and paint our nails, as well as dye our clothes. So the lack bug has been super important.
Now, one of the things your book explores is this idea of kind of making insects, or at least remaking them in a way that suits our purposes. How have insects inspired engineers of all types?
Oh, in so many ways. So when I talk about fabricating insects, that can take many, many forms, either by engineers, by architects, by artists and others. So if we think about engineers using biomimicry or mimicking nature, there are solutions that have played out over hundreds of millions of years by insects. And those same solutions from head to tarsus could be applied to engineering problems that humans face. And so there are countless examples. I just skim a little surface of examples that I was really excited about in the book to explore these mimicries, these engineering marvels from insect origins. Some can be from the compound eyes of insects. Some can be from the wings of insects. Some can be looking at how insects move across uneven terrain in order to build robots. Some will match the decentralized control across a number of robots that try to mimic ants or other colonial insects, for example. Some of my favorite examples involve artists trying to exquisitely replicate insects either in part or in toto. So for example, there's an artist, Haruo Mitsuha, in Japan who applies a really old cultural practice, jizai okimono, which is to take either fantastical creatures or real organisms like insects and replicate them in metal, but not only in metal, articulated so that you can pull open the sheath-like four wings of a beetle and unfold or unravel the wings, the hind wings of the beetle, and move each leg segment and move the mandibles.
The final thing that you explore in this book kind of gets to this idea of really analyzing insects, exploring their bodies, and learning in some ways things about the human condition through insects, whether that's being inspired in how we dress, how we dance, and also how we fight. How has the insect world influenced how humans behave?
Really great question. And it's a lot of ways. I mentioned this idea of decentralized control, and it's the idea that you don't have one overbearing ruler that makes all the decisions, but rather you spread out the decision-making across a collective and see what emerges most democratically. And I think one of the most effective examinations was by Tom Seeley in The Honeybee Democracy, where in the last chapter, he looks at human decision-making. And he was struck with being a chairperson for his neurobiology behavior department. And he decided to look to his honeybees. How do they make decisions? Could I apply that to human decision-making? And he analyzed the five different steps or criteria that allow people to do so effectively, at least under some circumstances. So there are a lot of ways decision-making and municipal practices could benefit by examining the collective decision-making and the collective practices of insects.
When you think about this book as a whole, what do you hope people take away from it?
My biggest hope, my not-so-hidden agenda, is that people not only tolerate the quintillions of insects around us, this most diverse of arthropods, 60% of all animal species, at least described, probably way more undescribed, are represented by these hexapod neighbors of ours, but that we begin to deeply appreciate them, taking the time out to observe so that we can celebrate these marvels all around us that are sadly diminishing at our hands. Instead, if we look at their myriad ways of affecting not only ecosystem services on which we depend, but the cultural services that have changed and shaped us as a species, I think we'd be in a better world.
Yeah. Well, Barrett, thank you so much for joining us here on Lake Effect and sharing your work.
My pleasure. I always love talking about insects. Thank you so much.
Barrett Klein is an animal behavior biologist and entomologist at UW-La Crosse. His book is called The Insect Epiphany: How Our Six-Legged Allies Shape Human Culture. We spoke last year. And that wraps up today's show. Thank you so much for being here with us. I'm Joy Powers. If you missed any of Lake Effect this week, you can find all of our conversations at WUWM.com. If you'd like to take the show on the go, you can download the Lake Effect podcast wherever you get your podcasts. Tomorrow on Lake Effect, we'll hear from the new director of Milwaukee Film. And ahead of Valentine's Day, we'll explore some of WUWM's favorite love songs. That's all tomorrow at noon, right here on listener-supported 89.7 WUWM, Milwaukee's NPR.